At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Is it too early to talk about holiday retail? Maybe, but we're going to do it anyway. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver today, I'm Amy Scott in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 15th of November. Great to have you with us. It was not a great day for British Prime Minister Theresa May. Just hours after negotiating a draft Brexit deal yesterday, she's now fighting to save that deal. Two cabinet ministers have resigned, and support for the plan in Parliament is looking increasingly shaky. The uncertainty helped push the British pound down nearly 2% against the dollar. That's the biggest drop since July 2016, just after UK voters confounded pre-election polls and voted in favor of Brexit. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what the markets are telling us when a currency takes a tumble.
Britain has been on a stomach-churning ride over the last 36 hours, and Jan Randolph's been riding along as head of sovereign risk at IHS Market in London.
There was brief relief yesterday when Mrs. May, the Prime Minister, had her cabinet meeting 5 hours long.
May appeared to have a plausible plan to take the UK out of the EU, so the British pound rallied. Then today,
ranks start to break, ministerial resignations, and a realization that Mrs. May is very unlikely to get this deal through Parliament, which would be very damaging for the economy.
So as currency traders price in that more damaging economic future, the British pound tanks.
Foreign exchange markets are really the short-term instantaneous barometer to what investors are thinking about a particular piece of news.
Paul Sheard at Harvard's Kennedy School says that's especially true with events like this that have a high degree of uncertainty. Markets hate uncertainty. Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute points out currency markets also react quickly.
This is a very liquid market. Billions of pounds or dollars are traded every day.
Ultimately, he says, what the sharp fall in British currency and equities is foretelling is trouble ahead for
transportation, logistics, air transport, trucking, financial services.
Indeed, any UK industry having anything to do with the rest of the world.
Advanced manufacturing, the British car industry.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now to a look at our own economy. We got a bit of a preview of the holiday shopping season as a handful of retailers reported their third quarter earnings. The world's largest retailer, Walmart, beat expectations and raised its sales forecast for the rest of the year. And the Commerce Department said today retail sales overall are up about 5% from this time last year. With low unemployment and consumer confidence at a 20-year high, analysts are expecting pretty strong holiday sales. And yet, email inbox boxes are overflowing with sale alerts and discount codes. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, go shopping, babe.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
It's only November 15th, and already Los Angeles resident Kelly Stevens has had it with the constant in-your-face enticements to shop.
you know, I'm not overwhelmed, I'm irritated.
She's always avoided breaking away from family to hunt down deals Thanksgiving weekend, so she's relieved. Now she doesn't have to, because the deals literally come to her. Online and in real life, it seems we've gone from Black Friday to Black Friday weekend to Black November to Black every minute of every day. Why?
Consumers have the expectation that they, you know, can find items at the price that they want almost, you know, whenever they want to shop.
Catherine Cullen with the National Retail Federation says coming out of the recession, shoppers got really savvy, maybe even relentless, about deal hunting. And the rise of e-commerce has made it easier than ever to find low prices all the time. But in real neighborhoods all over the country, small businesses want to get in on that holiday feeling and spending. Many hope to lure shoppers next weekend during so-called Small Business Saturday, an effort by merchants to keep spending local.
They want to offer more of an experience, provide that face time, and have it be a more leisurely experience.
Kara Taub is helping organize an event in Santa Monica, California, to boost neighborhood businesses that struggle to compete with the deep discounts of retail giants. Because sure, you can get a Roku online, but you might want to leave the house to find that artisanal, bedazzled dog collar in just the right size. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, not so rosy on retail, but all in all, an up day. We'll have details when we do the numbers. This next story is one of those cases where the headline economic numbers don't always capture the economic reality on the ground. Though unemployment is at a near 50-year low, work for many Americans is getting more precarious and more temporary. According to economists at Princeton and Harvard, most of the new jobs created in the last decade or so were what's called alternative work, as in on-call, contract, freelance, or temp. At many companies, those workers are baked into the business model. That includes car companies, which once offered some of the more stable, well-paying jobs out there. As part of our Divided Decade project on the economic changes since the Great Recession, Marketplace's Scott Tong traveled to a Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi.
Every day at this Nissan plant, more than 6,000 workers take a sheet of steel and stamp it, paint it, weld it, and assemble it into a finished car. Most wear the company-issued red-top, gray pants. But the pay is not uniform. Permanent technicians make $25 an hour. And others make as little as 13, and they're temps. Nissan line worker Eric Hearn is a former temp himself.
They're making it be 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There's some people out there got 7, 8 years on and still on the temp status.
He's just off night shift, sipping coffee outside at a gas station. Hearn says when he was a temp, he thought about this.
I believe in equal pay. I'm right there beside, working right there beside a legacy worker on the line. I'm doing the same identical job as he or she doing.
But several workers told us about a 15-point employee rating system based on performance, attendance, and attitude.
It depends on your score.
Nissan line worker Antonio Ivy is another former temp.
If you don't score high to that criteria, you'll end up 2, 3, 4 years before you become permanent.
Is that common?
Yeah, it's common. Yeah, it's common.
Common across the auto sector, says Susan Hausman at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Michigan.
The auto industry has been known for quite a while to be a pretty heavy user of temporary services. It would not be unusual for 20 to even 30% of the production line to be temps.
She says automakers lean on temps for a couple reasons. One, they're cheaper. And two, they're a business cycle shock absorber, coming and going depending on how sales go. Every entry-level factory worker here goes through a Nissan-approved staffing firm. MineAct Incorporated is one of them. Vice President Jacqueline Beasley.
Our hiring activity is driven by the needs of Nissan. They will give us a job order to say we need to bring in, just hypothetically, 10 additional technicians.
A decade ago, when the Great Recession hit, Beasley says this plant cut hundreds of contract positions. Officially, Nissan did not lay off a single Nissan worker. Effectively, it outsourced the hiring and outsourced the layoffs. None of the Nissan temps we spoke to would go on tape. They feared managers would retaliate. Nissan denies that would happen. It declined to share specifics on how many temps it has or how they get promoted. Rodney Francis is HR director at the Canton, Mississippi plant.
It's pretty standard and common practice to utilize contract workers. And quite honestly, not limited to the automotive industry.
It's not Nissan's plan, he says, to keep temps long term. They can go permanent if they earn it.
There's a lot of people that think they can do it. And then when they actually get out there on the shop floor to actually do the work, some of them find that this isn't for them, or they have to get better, or continue to try to get better, get feedback so that they're eligible.
He says every job at this plant pays well for the area. Now, the concept of temps is not new. In the 1940s, the entrepreneur William Kelly in Detroit began supplying short-term so-called Kelly girls to companies needing help.
They were historically used just for short periods of time.
Brandeis University labor economist David Weil. But this past generation,
businesses increasingly have decided to use that kind of employment relationship to do ongoing work.
In other words, permatemps. In the Great Recession, companies relied heavily on temps. And then when things recovered, something surprised Weil. Firms stayed with them.
A lot of these businesses, I think, started to say, hey, this is pretty cool. I've shedded a lot of the headaches of employment.
To him, norms are changing. The social contract between employer and worker is coming apart. Many auto workers in Mississippi echo that. They assume temp means temporary until I get promoted. But maybe not. Again, Nissan technician Eric Hearn, the former temp.
Some of these folks traveling 100, 200 miles a day for $14 an hour. That's ridiculous.
The question in his mind is not whether it's a good salary for Mississippi. It's whether workers share in the company's prosperity. In Canton, Mississippi, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A lot of workers see a college degree as a key to a good job, but what kind of degree has been changing? Since the financial crisis a decade ago, humanities majors have been on the decline. Degrees in history, philosophy, English, and journalism have been passed over by students in favor of science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM for short, which are seen, not entirely accurately, to lead to better jobs after college. Now, even elite liberal arts colleges known for their strong humanities programs are feeling the shift. Jeff Salingo is a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's great to be here.
How are colleges adapting to this shift? I mean, you write that unlike, say, an auto plant, you can't just retool the factory. These are tenured professors, you know, that they have a job for life. How are they changing the labor force?
So many of them are hiring more computer science professors than ever before, including at McAllister in Minnesota, where they had a history and English opening that they didn't even fill this year. And that's at, you know, an elite liberal arts college. So many of them are shifting in that direction. But as you mentioned, most professors they hire, they're hiring for, you know, 30-year positions plus, and they're a little worried about making these long-term bets on these fields, not knowing what the job market's going to look like in 5 or 10 years.
And you also talked about sort of promotional campaigns these schools are doing to get more students to take humanities or to inject a little bit of humanities into the STEM courses.
Yeah. So what some schools are doing is they're sending letters and promotional materials to students to tell them about the humanities. But what seems to be happening is that many students are indicating they're interested in the humanities on their applications. But then once they declare their major, their first or second year of college, that's when they're deciding that math and science and STEM fields are more popular for them. And so some schools, for example, Stanford told me they're less worried about the drop in humanities majors. Students are finding the courses interesting, but they're not necessarily majoring in the humanities.
Well, it's interesting because many of the skills that employers say that they want and that are sometimes lacking in today's graduates are the ones associated with the humanities, like critical thinking skills, you know, reading, writing, communication. Are students missing out by shifting to a more STEM-focused major if they're not getting some of those skills?
most jobs today require a mix of both the soft and hard skills, right? The ability to communicate, the ability to work in teams and problem solve. It's the soft skills that most employers say they don't get out of today's college graduates. And we know that most of those skills are taught in humanities courses. The problem is that many of these courses and majors don't help students translate those skills for employers. But when they get into job interviews, they have a hard time talking about what they learned and how that can translate to the job that they hope to get.
So I got to throw in a question about the elephant in the room in terms of employment right now, and that's Amazon, which just announced its new dual second headquarters in Virginia and New York. How do these kinds of employers, these big tech companies, impact how colleges are gearing their students?
I think what's happening is that most colleges look at the hottest jobs and then start to create majors. The problem is that most of the jobs are not easily packaged into a major. Today, most students, because they're worried about the cost of higher education, their parents are worried about them getting a job, these majors that are marketed by colleges are tantalizing because they think, oh, I'm going to get a job because it's in computer science or in data analytics or in social media management or whatever it might be. That might help them get their first job, but they're not going to have the breadth of skills to get promoted or find that second and third job.
Jeff Salingo writes about higher education for The Atlantic. Thank you so much.
It was great to be here.
Coming up,
I took off like an afternoon to have a baby, and then I, was right back at it.
Moms at work. But first, let's do the numbers. A rally in tech stocks put investors in a buying mood today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 208 points, 0.8%, to end at 25,289. The S&P 500 added 28 points, or 1%, to close at 2730. And the NASDAQ shot up 122 points, 1.7%, to close at 7259. Setting the tone for the rebound in tech, Apple waxed higher, nearly 2.5%. Microsoft computed gains of 2%, and Twitter rose 0.7%. Higher retail sales didn't impress investors, though. Shares of Kohl's unraveled 3.4%. Target fell short 2.8%. Walmart crumbled nearly 2%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.11%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We had the shopper's perspective on the retail economy earlier from Megan, but there's also the view that comes from behind the store counter. That's where our series My Economy comes in. It's our once-in-a-while look at people making a go of it.
My name is Kristen Tallheimer Bingham. I live in Portland, Maine. My husband and I have a small business called Dean Sweets, and we make and sell hand-dipped chocolates. Before we started our business, my husband was an architect, and I had just completed my MBA in 2002. Dean was in particular looking for a second business, and he makes amazing chocolates, so we tossed around the idea of starting a chocolate business. And that's when the recession hit. So in 2008, you can imagine that the world of architecture kind of collapsed at the same time. So we found a really nice, very small spot, 700 square feet. We decided we would make a go of it. I do all the day-to-day stuff, the operations. Dean, my husband, is really the chocolate maker, so he's in the kitchen. Dean makes this amazing hot fudge sauce, and when he's making it, the place smells so good. After a few years, after, you know, we started coming out of the recession, then we moved to our new space and we got bigger and we started to hire a few people. The economy is growing. People feel comfortable and confident to spend money. They feel like they can indulge a little bit in themselves. It does feel like it could change very suddenly. You know, it feels like we could go into another recession. What 2008 showed us is that people don't stop buying a few small luxuries. We laughed about it. I don't have any data on this, but I think the wine shop still did well. People were looking for a little escape. if we fall into another recession, there would still be people out there who would be looking for some high-quality chocolate.
I know I am. The series only works with your help. So let us know how your economy is doing at marketplace.org. There's a line in journalist Amy Westervelt's new book that I'm guessing will resonate with a lot of working moms out there. After all the progress women have made in the workforce, she writes, we still ask mothers to parent as though they don't work and work as though they don't parent. And yes, I know a lot of working dads probably feel that way too. Westervelt has been digging into how we got this way and how history, the economy, race, and many other forces have shaped American motherhood. Her book is called Forget Having It All, How America Messed Up Motherhood and How to Fix It. Amy Westervelt, welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. So you open the book with a personal anecdote. I'm wondering if you could just read the first three lines of chapter one, which I should say is called Being a Mother Shouldn't Suck.
Okay, here you go. I am writing this book hip deep in the chaos that is modern American motherhood. My children are young, 2 and 5. My bills are high. And my career is in an industry that is a uniquely bad fit for parents. Journalism. In the course of my research, my bank account has been overdrawn 6 times. I've lost health insurance and then managed to get it again. And I've had my car repossessed. I've had to find new childcare arrangements 2 and threatened to divorce my husband at least as many times.
That kind of says it all right there. But talk about how your personal experiences with motherhood kind of influenced the decision to write this book.
I had this experience with my second kid who was very unplanned. At the time, my husband was not working and I was self-employed. You know, I was a freelance journalist. And I took off like an afternoon to have a baby. And then I, was right back at it. And I was filing stories the next day. And I remember feeling like kind of self-righteous a little bit, like, yes, I'm doing everything. And like, no one even knew I had a baby. And I'm supporting a family of 4. And like, look at me. And then I realized how really messed up that was. So that kind of led to me wanting to dig into, you know, how a lot of our ideas about motherhood in the U.S. came about.
You offer a lot of solutions in the book, which I found helpful. And something that came up a lot is the need to kind of reframe how we think about caregiving, to value it as much as we value individual success.
I'm not the first person to point out that our culture largely thrives on competition and not caregiving. But I do feel like actually giving real value to it, not just in terms of cultural and social value, but also actual monetary value, is necessary. A lot of what I'm reading anyway is saying, you know, we need men to do more. We need men to be more involved. But why would anyone want to take on a task that is not valued? You know, I feel like even when you outsource caregiving, it's usually to an underpaid woman. What message is that sending about how we value that task?
Well, I also wonder if we would value motherhood and caregiving more if we valued children more. Is that part of this story?
Yeah, there's like this odd way in which, as sort of a commodity, we value children, you know. But there has come this idea that kids are a burden, which I kind of feel like has been happening a little bit since kids were not allowed to work.
They are more valuable when they could contribute to the bottom line.
Yes, yeah. I mean, in like the early 1900s, as the Industrial Revolution was getting underway, quite a few of the factory workers were women and children. At that time, custody battles were fairly rare, but when they did happen, children were always given to the father because they had economic value.
Wow.
As soon as labor laws kicked kids out of the workplace, it was like, oh, give them to the mother.
One of your policy fixes is to get more working moms into government. And this past election, we did see an influx of successful women candidates for public office. What do you think that could mean for some of the solutions that you propose?
You know, you can't, of course, assume that every woman or every mother is going to have the same ideas about policy. But I do feel like having working moms in office who know what it's like will have a little bit more insight into what's needed to improve it. A lot of the politicians right now, if they do have young kids, which most of them don't, they often have a spouse at home who takes care of all of the childcare and housework stuff. And that is super unusual these days. But yet we have so many systems in place that actually just assume that that's the family you have.
Mm-hmm.
I have a kid in school, and I swear the whole public school system assumes one parent is just always available. And
To bake,
yeah, or like show up in the middle of the day. Yeah, exactly.
Amy Westervelt, her book is called Forget Having It All, How America Messed Up Motherhood and How to Fix It. Even if you're not a mom, you should read it. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There's a lot more to our conversation, including some unintended consequences of paid parental leave, at marketplace.org. This final note, which I truly hope my kids are not hearing, Sour Patch Kids, the candy, will soon be a breakfast cereal too. And like the original, the new Post-brand cereal will start out sour, then turn sweet through the wonders of food science. You gotta wonder what that does to the milk, though. Boxes will hit store shelves initially only at Walmart on December 26th, I guess just in time for the Christmas sugar high to wear off. All right, we got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 208 points today, 0.8%. The S&P 500 added 28 points, or 1%, and the NASDAQ shot up 122 points, 1.7%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, Karen McKella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Defke. And I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a good evening. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.